You're listening to Brick to the Future, the property investment show for everyday Australians. We cut through the white noise so you can minimise risk and make smart, informed investment decisions. If you're after tips and strategies while building a property portfolio that suits your lifestyle, you're in the right place.
Equity, how does it work? In our last podcast, Michael Beresford talked about using the knowledge and the equity that you develop from buying your first investment property, be able to leapfrog into your second, third, and fourth without having to save for another deposit. It's mind-blowing stuff. I think he called it his light bulb moment. He's here with me today to share the ins and outs of equity, how it's calculated, how you can put it to use, and what are the risk mitigation strategies to ensure that once you've created equity, you don't lose it. Boz, welcome.
G'day, Louis. That's one hell of a pump up, mate. It's amazing what light bulb moments get us. It's great to be able to share these insights with our listeners today. It's a game changer, understanding equity and how it works. So looking forward to getting into it.
Well, why don't you start there? Tell us about it.
Okay. Equity, how does it work? Well, pretty simply, equity is the difference between what an asset's worth and the debt that you have on it. So for example, property's worth $800,000. You've got a $500,000 loan. There's $300,000 of equity. The bank won't ever let you access 100% of the equity. They'll let you go up to 90%, typically as a general rule. So, you know, when you're saving really hard to get that first deposit and then you've got an asset and that asset starts growing for you, that's kind of like the coil in a spring just waiting to kind of propel you forward with the rest of your portfolio. So once you've created equity, you don't actually have to use cash for growing your portfolio and getting your next property. In that example that I talked about, if you have available equity of $100,000 or more, as a general rule, you can borrow that equity and you use that as the deposit and costs for the next property. Now, the common questions we get asked are, well, how do you do that? And does it cost me to access that equity? So in reverse order, yes, it does cost you to access that equity. Just like any loan that you take from a bank, you need to pay the interest on it. Okay. But the great news is that if you set it up the right way, the interest on that equity loan, as we call it, is tax deductible because the purpose of those funds are for investment. Okay, so straight away, you can start to get more tax benefit. Secondly, the way that you set it up is critical. So some of our listeners out there might have heard of the term cross-collateralization. I think that's the first time I've ever got it out in 20 years. That is the process, simply put, where you have everything bundled together with the same bank. And often we get told, oh, Michael, but my bank knows me really well. Or I've got a great relationship with the person there, or they give me a discount on the rate. All of these really, really common things. We'll make it really easy for you because we understand your stuff. But they're all the kind of selling points around this relationship that banks want to have with you. I used to work at Telstra before I got involved in property, and the discussions on a regular basis would be if a customer had their mobile phone, their fixed phone, their Big Pond internet and their Foxtel with you, it was so hard for them to move that the client retention was amazing. Yeah. And it's kind of like the same thing with a bank. If you've got all of your loans with them, it's just too hard to move. Most people can't be bothered, so they leave it. Okay. Now, the issue with that and cross-collateralization specifically is that your first property, which is in a lot of cases your own home, is direct security against the loan that you take for the investment property. Now, there's a positive and a negative to that. The positive is that you're using equity to springboard and build your portfolio. Massive tick on that. The negative, and it's a really big negative, is that your home then becomes directly at risk if anything were to happen to you or to the investment and you couldn't service the loan. Okay, and that's the last thing that we want. It's so hard to accumulate our first deposit to get our property. We love our castle. We want the best of both worlds. And the good news is that that's possible. So you can go back to the bank that has the mortgage on the initial property. You can set up that equity loan, let's say for $100,000, and we might even put an image up here for those that can see it. You use that equity loan for the deposit and costs, and then when you go to get the loan for the remainder, it's really important you go to a different bank so that the only exposure that the second bank has is on the investment property. Your home is not directly tied to it, and you've got a firewall between the properties.
So just as we talk about this concept, and so we've got a principal place of residence that's got some debt against it. We're going to increase that debt through an equity loan and essentially get cash out. We're going to say to the bank, we'll give you an extra $100,000 of security against my home. You give me $100,000 of cash. I can take that cash, put it down as a deposit on another property, and then I'm borrowing the rest of that property's purchase price from a different lender, right?
Exactly.
So when people are thinking about this and they're saying, well, how is it a lower risk? Because I've still got the same amount of debt, whether it was cross-collateralized.
Well done.
or not. So what are the main things? And is it all just about financial risk, or are there other components to it, whether it's psychological or perhaps even negotiating with the lender? Because ultimately, I think a lot of Australians have this thought that if they defaulted on a loan, and look, that's the worst case scenario. If they defaulted, I mean, what could lead to them defaulting on a property investment loan to start with? And why is it a lower risk if they defaulted there, if they're not cross-collateralized? And what are the outcomes that they might expect?
Yeah, there's a lot there. I'll try and keep it in a logical order for our audience. So first things first, with regards to borrowing the equity, okay? This is where terminology is really important. We're not increasing, again, I'll use that example, $800,000 property with a $500,000 loan. Let's say we're taking a $100,000 equity loan, which is that cash for the deposit and costs. Okay. Most importantly, we're not increasing the mortgage to $600,000. We're keeping the $500,000 mortgage as is, and your repayments on that owner-occupied mortgage won't change. We're just going back to the same bank and we're setting up a separate loan for an additional $100,000. Okay, and that's what we're using for the deposit and costs. Now, the reason why that's so important, number one, is because the only source of money you've got to be able to repay your mortgage is your post-tax income. So it's much wiser to be using that money to repay $500,000 than it is $600,000. Secondly, is around the tax benefits. So the interest payments on your mortgage are not tax deductible, but the interest repayments on an investment loan are tax deductible. So if you have a $500,000 mortgage with a separate $100,000 loan, the interest on that $100,000 loan is deductible. If you just do what some banks would suggest and say, top up your mortgage, they'll increase the $500 to $600, your repayments will go up. And it's nearly impossible to prove to the tax office what portion of that is owner-occupied and what portion is investment debt. And because you can't clearly separate that, chances are it's not going to be deductible, past the ATO kind of acid test, if you like. So that's the first thing. The second thing comes to control and flexibility, as you talked about. Now, let's say that this $800,000 property, in order for us to be able to establish an equity loan or to borrow again against it, whether it to be refinance as is or to extract equity as the cash out for a deposit and costs, the bank will always nominate a valuer to go out and value that property. Now, let's say that valuer A values it at $700,000, valuer B values it at $750,000, and valuer C values the same property at $800,000. Now, it's all the same property, but the difference between getting $800,000 as opposed to $700,000, purely because that valuer knows the local market better, is more experienced, whatever range of reasons that you can't control, right? If you don't have it all tied in with the same bank, then you're free to go to different lenders to get valuations of that property And then depending on which one gives you the best valuation, you can then control that process of refinancing to extract as much equity as you can. And that's from personal experience. That's why I get so passionate about this finance structure stuff, because I got cross-collateralized. I had no transparency around valuations. I was told I didn't have enough equity to proceed, even though I should have, based on my debt levels and the values. It's just that the bank was controlling that valuation process. The next extension of that is thinking about building a portfolio, right? Let's say that you've got two properties, and one's in the state that you live in, obviously your own home, and one's interstate. Now, chances are those markets are going to move upwards at different times. They're not all going to move upwards together. If you've got both properties with the same bank, then they'll effectively split the difference on that market performance to give you equity for the next one. Whereas if you have your own home with bank one and the investment property with bank two, and either your home goes up in value or the investment goes up in value, you just have to go back to bank one or bank two respectively, and you repeat the process of extracting the equity, and you're into your next property much earlier than if you had everything bundled together. So it can get a little bit complex. Hopefully that's been simple enough to understand, but really it comes down to step number one, security and keeping your own home safe. Number two, flexibility to duplicate when you want and when you can. Number three, transparency, especially around the valuation process, because if you want to be building a portfolio of investments, you need to know exactly how much equity you have in any property at any point in time based on the latest valuation that you got.
It's a really good point there. I know it's something that affected my father as well early in his journey. He just, you know, is a relationship guy. He had one banker.
Yeah.
And he banked with them for 15 years and then had a holiday house, not the wisest investment choice, but you know, he got to the point where he could make bad decisions and it didn't affect him that much. And it was included in the overall assets that were secured by that lender. And so he wanted to borrow against one of his properties to, you know, he thought the market had gone up, he'll borrow against that to buy something else. And they said, well, we're going to value everything. And because the holiday home had essentially halved in value from when he bought it until that point in time, they said, sorry, Steve, we're not giving you any more money to buy another investment property. In fact, can you give us a couple hundred thousand dollars cash, because that's gone down so far. You need to rebalance your LVR. They also, over time, changed their rules. The more properties you own, the lower the LVR would get if you had it all with one bank. And he got hit by, I guess, these kind of these two forces that kind of meant that he had to come up with some cash really quickly. And had he avoided cross-collateralization, he would never have been in that situation, because banks don't just randomly go and value a property unless you're asking them for something. Obviously, as you said, you choose, if you've got three, four, five properties, you're choosing which property you get valued at any point in time, and then you're choosing which lender you take that property to in order to obtain the cash that you might need or want to make your next investment.
That's a good point. Just to extend on that with, you know, a recent example, I guess, to help our listeners be able to quantify why this is so important. We had a client right before COVID. It was 2019. We went back to the lender that they'd been with for a long time. Despite our recommendations to explore refinancing, they decided to stay with that lender. They got a very conservative valuation on their existing property. We convinced them, look, let's explore alternatives. They got a much better result through a new lender, refinanced and pulled out the equity loan and duplicated at that point. Now, that property that they bought it for $572,000 in Brisbane at the very start of 2020, and it's now worth $830,000. So if you're thinking they're listening to this going, oh, but changing banks is hard, or I need to supply documents, or it's a bit of a hassle, or where am I going to find the 60 minutes to do that? I'm pretty sure that if you could receive a check for $250,000 in 3 years' time, most people would find an hour to improve their own personal situation and control more of that process. So even though property is a long-term investment, it doesn't mean that on a regular basis, we shouldn't be doing things to tweak and improve our portfolio in the short term to improve the overall long-term result.
Yeah, look, Boz, I have to call you out on something though. I think you're cherry picking there. It's what, 230,000, 260,000 for an hour's work. It's not that simple. It's only $80,000 a year for, oh wait, no, that still sounds pretty good, doesn't it?
You had me worried that I got my maths wrong. I think surely not.
No. Look, you put it in great perspective because it's a little bit of effort, not a lot, a little bit of effort, but to enable you to grow your portfolio. And obviously, though that client, that investor, didn't have to sell their first property to get the extra money to buy the property in Queensland that's gone up by over 200,000 in 3 years. They still had their first property and any others they owned that were also going up as the market improved in that period of time as well. So it's about these one percenters, right? About knowing which are the key activities and which are the key structures to set up and key activities to pursue at any point in time to put yourself in the best position to make money. And, you know, it's not, let's face it, it's not rocket science. There is certainly a science to it. And there's processes you can follow, but you don't need to be a Rhodes Scholar or a rocket scientist to understand them and to put them to use. You just need to know what they are. And I've seen time and time again, so many people chat to you, and then the next time I'm speaking to them, they're like, oh my gosh, it just was so simple. Like, I can't believe that I thought that there was a different way to do it. Then I had to kind of be a genius to work out which was the best property to buy without any support or any process.
I'm glad that's the feedback that we enjoy, bringing people on the journey, and if they can bring the motivation, then we can help do the rest. But I think it's that's the exciting part, right? It's quite often it's helping people understand the fundamentals to get started. The analogy I use is you don't turn up on day one of prep trying to pass year 12 maths. There's a sequence and a process, and once you learn the fundamentals, then we can graduate, if you like, onto some of the more complex stuff and the equity process and the valuation process, and those strategies can evolve as you go down your investment journey, and we can provide that kind of insight. But when we need banks as part of this process, it's very hard. Very, very few people can buy property without banks. While they're a necessary part of the process, if we can control as much of it as possible, it just stacks the cards in our favor in terms of achieving successful outcomes.
100%. And I think it's a really good phrase, stacking the cards in your favor, because that's what successful property investment is about. There's two things we haven't really touched on just yet that are kind of tied right into this issue and topic. Now, forgive me if you did touch on it, but I didn't pick up. Do banks offer better deals to their existing customers or to new customers they're trying to win?
I thought about putting that in, but I thought it'd interrupt the explanation. So, no, believe it or not, banks are probably the one organization out there that throws the kitchen sink to attract new customers. And gives their long-term loyal customers or existing customers a raw deal. They've recently come out of the lending marketplace for the 2 or 3 years before that, there were a lot of incentives and cashback offers to refinance. There were lower interest rates offered to new clients as opposed to the interest rates that existing borrowers were on. Just as a starting point, we can summarize and say that existing clients get the raw end of the stick. So, if that's the way that banks are looking at their or treating loyalty, I guess, then absolutely, be prepared to shop around, because if you're refinancing on a regular basis every couple of years or so, then over a 10 to 15 year period, it can make tens of thousands of dollars worth of difference, if not more.
Yeah, spot on. And I think again, that was a great lesson I learned from watching my dad go through his challenges with being a single bank investor.
Yeah.
Al and I, so my brother Al and I, were able to get better deals than he did, taking one property to a bank at a time. And he just used to shake his head and he was baffled. In fact, sometimes we'd go to his bank and they'd give us a better deal than he was getting with all of his property with them. And he thought there should be some sort of bulk discount. And it was almost the opposite. Like you said, with Telstra knowing that loyalty to Telstra was greatest if somebody was already tied in with lots of different products. It's exactly the same with the banks, and they knew it. They knew that he wasn't going to leave until he turned up and said, I've got an offer, I'm ready to go. Suddenly, they were ready to negotiate. Now, we also talked about the kind of different risks, and you know, you can have the same amount of debt owned with two or three different banks than you have, as you would have with one bank where they have all of your properties and all of your debt tied together. But it presents a lower risk. Now, some people might hear that and say, well, where is the risk? What's my risk and why do I need to mitigate it? And how does that kind of save my house? And I think what I'm looking for here is just maybe the practical aspect of it, not necessarily the theory of kind of separating, but
yeah.
What circumstance would somebody actually need to have this risk mitigation in place?
Yeah, sure. So let's say that you had your own home, you had an investment property, that they're tied together with the same bank, and something happens to you, and you can't work for a period of time, or something happens to the property and there's not rent coming in, for whatever reason. You're not able to service the mortgage repayments on that property. Now, if in a worst case scenario, if the bank wants to kind of repossess that property, if those properties are separate and financed by different banks, then the only thing that bank number two can do is sell the investment property. They've got no direct interest in your own home at all. But if those two properties are cross-collateralized, the easiest way, all the bank cares about in that situation is how am I going to get my money back? And given that you had your own home first, they'll most likely sell that property because it's security against the investment property. They'll probably turn up 9 a.m. Monday morning and sell it for less than what it's worth. So in what is an unfortunate set of circumstances, you're getting hit a second time. As long as they can sell it for enough to make their money back, they're happy. So, that's why it's really important to, as we call, build that firewall between the two. You might be thinking, well, what if, bank two can't get their money back? Well, that's a great position to be in relative to having your own home sold, because you've got an opportunity to work with your existing bank on how you can top up, how you can satisfy bank two, how you can stay in your house, whatever it might be. But I think this is where buffers and so on become really, really important, and the refinancing aspect, because as you build a portfolio, if you're keeping a large enough buffer there and you ensure that you've always got rent coming in, that very small holding cost for the first couple of years, you can use that buffer to service that. So even before, I'm answering the question because you asked it around the worst case scenario and the protection, but there's a good two or three preventative measures that you can put in place to ensure that you don't even get into that situation to start with, just by having prudent financial structures and buffers in place.
100%. I think the way that I think of it is that a bank will take the easiest course of action to recoup their money. So if they have, let's call it, you've got one investment property and your principal place of residence, and there's a tenant in that investment property, and they're there for they've signed a lease, they're there for at least a year. It's pretty hard for the bank to wind that up and sell it.
True.
They don't need to give you kind of any, you don't have to go through VCAT and all the other statutory processes to evict a property owner that lives in the property themselves. They just have to give you notice to say, we're prepossessing this and we're going to sell it, and you will be out. And that happens really quickly. So as you touched on, if the bank doesn't have access to your principal place of residence and they're just looking at an investment property that they can't sell, it's not liquid immediately, you're in a much better position to negotiate, to ride through that period of time and either work out a sale plan to sell in your own time or to be able to catch back up. And again, if you're talking about a personal situation where your income has been diminished, then in that circumstance, then there are other things that, as you said, you can do. There's income protection insurance. If you've lost your job or your earning potential because of, you know, a physical ailment or a range of different reasons that keep you out of the workforce. And then there are also other areas where you can go. And if you've got a lot of equity in that house and you only have one mortgage or you've only got a mortgage with one lender on that house, then banks will generally work with you in that case. So you're not taking on an additional risk. You're keeping them very separate and, in fact, reducing your risk by going to another bank. So again, it's one of the 1%ers. They all add up. I think the last few times we've caught up, Boz, to talk about the different tips and tricks that we've got, I think I've used the term 1% at least 10 times. So that's 10% extra in investment potential that someone has when they've just used those 10 tips that you've shared in the last couple of weeks.
10% extra over 15 years can make a massive difference. So I'm glad we're doing the 1%ers, Matt, and hopefully learning a bit more about equity and how it works has been beneficial for our listeners.
Awesome. Thanks for your time, Boz. Always insightful and looking forward to catching up with you next.
Yeah, love chatting to you. Thanks, Matt.